Today is Thursday, June 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What are the chances there will be a second wave of COVID-19 cases later this year?
It's impossible to predict with any degree of certainty.
Plus, a veteran police officer responds to the defund the police movement.
Defunding to us means that you're trying to, you want to do away with us.
And can the looming crisis in Lebanon be avoided? Those stories and more next. The United States has gone over the 2 million mark in the total cases of the novel coronavirus. As many as 21 states have recorded their highest number of COVID-19 cases this week, with many concentrated across the western and southwestern states. The increases come amid a loosening of coronavirus restrictions in recent weeks, including ahead of the Memorial Day holiday at the end of May that signals the start of the traditional summer vacation season. Experts also fear the ongoing nationwide protests sparked by the death of an African-American man in Minneapolis while in police custody will lead to another spike of COVID-19 infections. VOA Russian Services Leslie Bakalets spoke with Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, via Skype. She began their conversation by asking Dr. Fauci about the possibility of a second wave.
It's impossible to predict with any degree of certainty what's going to happen. The one thing we do know will happen is that there will be infections in the fall and in the winter. We know that because this virus is so transmissible, it's not going to spontaneously disappear from the planet. We'll have it. Whether or not we have a second wave in the fall and winter will be totally dependent upon our ability and our effectiveness to be able to identify, isolate, and contact trace these new cases when they come up. If we do that effectively, we can prevent a second wave. It is not inevitable that we're going to have a second wave. We can prevent it if we do the right thing.
But to track new cases, we need testing kits, correct? And is there really a testing kit shortage now? And can people who don't have symptoms be like easily tested?
Well, I know that's why it makes contact tracing very difficult. It's not impossible, but it's difficult to do, particularly when you have situations where people are spreading infection, but they're not symptomatic themselves.
I have to ask about the World Health Organization and its statement about asymptomatic patients. I know that there are a lot of media coverage, but still, what is your opinion? And do you believe that asymptomatic patients can transmit the infection as well as symptomatic?
Well, it's not what I believe. It's what the truth is. They can. The data is clear that you know, about 25 to 50% of people who are infected are asymptomatic. We know that asymptomatic individuals can transmit it. We do not know what the extent of that is, but we know that it is not rare.
And my last question is more general. Some people believe that the world will never be the same. And do you think there is a chance and, moreover, hope that we will be able to get back to our normal life somewhere in the future?
I believe so. I believe that our experience with this devastating outbreak will make us be much more aware of the ability of respiratory infections to spread easily. So I think that there will be care. But I think that gradually, it may take a couple of years, but gradually we will get back to normal so that maybe someday you and I could have an interview in person.
Oh, it would be great.
This will end for sure, and we will be able to get back to normal. So what you need to do is you need to stay safe, take care of yourself. When you go out, wear a mask, don't go in crowds. So you've got to be careful. Even though we're opening up, we still have a level of infection that we've got to pay attention to.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He will be speaking to VOA Russian Services' Leslie Bakalets. The World Health Organization says the coronavirus pandemic is accelerating in Africa, spreading from capital cities where it arrived with travelers. 10 countries are driving Africa's epidemic, accounting for 75% of about the 200,000 cases on the continent, which has 5,000 deaths. South Africa accounts for a quarter of those cases. And there are over 7.3 million cases worldwide, according to a Johns Hopkins University tracker. And in financial news, Asian shares have tumbled as reports of rising numbers of coronavirus infections in many countries raise fears over the risk from reopening after the pandemic shutdowns. Regional markets opened lower Thursday after a retreat on Wall Street as investors took into account the Federal Reserve Bank's expectations for a long path to recovery from the pandemic. The Fed said it would keep interest rates low through 2022. The Fed has cut its benchmark short-term rate to near zero as part of a historic effort to counter the economic ravages of the coronavirus pandemic. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down more than 2.5% in early trading. Since the May 25th death of African-American George Floyd while in police custody, Americans have been protesting and demanding reforms in police departments worldwide. One movement that has garnered national attention has been to defund the police. I spoke to Dr. David Thomas, a forensic studies professor at Florida Gulf Coast University via Skype. Dr. Thomas is an expert in policing in America and a veteran police officer specializing in mental health, police, and minority relations. I began our conversation by asking Dr. Thomas what he thought the role of police should be in American society.
The role here in America is a very diverse role. When I started, all it was in 1978, the job was people violated the law. It was take and put those violators in jail. It evolved, and I can tell you because I started in 78 and I retired in 1998. So I've kind of gone through each one of these decades with this understanding. And somewhere in the 80s, when they let everybody out of the mental institutions and they just turned them loose on the streets, we all of a sudden became health workers with no training. Today, there's some training, but there's no training. And we are responsible for making an assessment of somebody if they're a threat to themselves or somebody else, and then transporting them. The 90s was going on. We still were doing the same thing, but we got better educated. You know, policing now, you know, CIT, which is officers are trained to be able to respond and deal with critical people who are in mental health crisis and have those conversations with them. After 9/11, the mission changed. Oh, let's go back. We had community policing. It afforded us an opportunity to get out of patrol cars. It was funded by the federal government where agencies could actually write grants. And then as a result of those grants, you had people that were assigned to do nothing but community police.
So given your expertise, given your experience, you know, what should the job, in your opinion, be?
It has to be a little bit of all, because there's one other thing that I got to kind of throw into this pot. 9/11 changed everything. The police mission changed from being, you know, like agencies wanted to be in partnership with their communities to actually having a responsibility to responding to terrorism. And so that meant that all the money that went in community policing that came from the federal government, it went into those efforts. The way I look at policing today, it should be a mixture of all of those things.
So I want to ask you this. So, you know, a lot of protest time is given to this notion of the chant, defund the police. Some rephrase it as reimagining of police forces, looking at municipalities, redistributing the funds. So, you know, with this topic in mind, where do you respond to those kinds of discussions?
When they talked about defunding, when the first one I heard of defunding, and I have several friends that are chiefs, and you can only imagine my phone just blew up. What are they talking about? They're crazy, you know. And I'm sitting here thinking, because we physically could not reimagine that what would happen if you said, okay, defunding to us means that you want to do away with us. We have dismantled one department in New Jersey, and that department rebuilt itself, Camden, New Jersey. And they did that with the idea that they could get, if they dismantled it and reorganized it, then what would happen is they could get rid of all the bad officers that had been protected by the union and a bunch of other things, and you had to reapply. New rookies coming in, they got to get out, they got to go walk on foot and knock on doors and go talk to people, they got to work a community. So when we talk about defunding, So I'm in one sense I'm adamantly opposed. But here's the rub. As I look and do research, I recognize that there are agencies that have mental health clinicians that are a part of their system and actually respond to calls. I foresee that as being the change, and a much needed change. Money is always going to be the issue.
So without consent decrees, without learning the lessons from the 1960s, the 1990s with Rodney King, the current issues with minority relations, you may not have the solution, but what is your best guess for moving forward?
I think you can't leave local problems to be local problems. So the greatest way to handle this issue would probably be state oversight, to create something just like the Justice Department did when they had consent decrees, to be able to have independent people come in, do the investigation, look at the data sets, and say, okay, this is what has to happen. And the state actually takes those agencies to court and hold them, and they can do the same thing and hold them accountable through some sort of decree that is done at the state level. Then you don't need the whole outside thing from the federal government. The other side of that is, if agencies are smart at this point, what they should be doing is reaching out to the community and having those conversations. And I don't mean the chiefs of police, because the chief sees it one way, and they have this the way they want their department to run. But the line guys, like I used to be, they need to be sitting in those meetings and having those conversations with people to understand what the people feel and what they see.
Dr. David Thomas is a forensic studies professor at Florida Gulf Coast University. The Black Lives Matter protests have prompted a wide rethinking of the U.S. legacy of slavery and racism that includes a push to remove memorials honoring leaders of the Confederate States, which had fought to break away from the country during the U.S. Civil War. In the eastern U.S. state of Virginia, a statue of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, was torn down Wednesday night in the U.S. city of Richmond, Virginia, once the capital of the rebel states. In Portsmouth, protesters beheaded and then pulled down four statues that were part of a Confederate monument as well. The removal of these statues follows similar incidents in Europe in recent days, when protests led to the removal of statues honoring slave traders and colonial powers. VOA has extended coverage of the worldwide protests on our website, and that address is voanews.com. Still to come,
the United Kingdom insists it is asking for nothing more than well-established precedent.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomer Edwin Hubble provided evidence that the universe was expanding back in 1929, and he came up with a unit of measurement called the Hubble constant to determine the rate of expansion. While scientists have disagreed with how fast the universe is expanding, most have long agreed that it's doing so in all directions and at the same rate, in a theory called the isotropy hypothesis. Researchers at the University of Bonn and Harvard University have released a new study that suggests the expansion of today's universe may not be uniform. Lead author Konstantinos Migas of the University of Bonn says he and his colleagues examined the behavior of over 800 galaxy clusters in the present universe. He suggests that if the isotropy hypothesis was correct, the properties of the clusters would all be even across the sky. But the researchers actually saw major differences. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The International Crisis Group says Lebanon needs urgent international help, as well as drastic reforms to protect its people from the worst economic crisis in its history. VOA's senior analyst, Mohamed El-Shenawy, discusses the crisis and possible aid with Joe Ma'akaran, a resident fellow at the Arab Center in Washington.
Let's say a combination, an accumulation of things. First, we have a very deeply rooted corruption in the system that accumulated over the decades. You have incompetence in governing. And also you have the regional instability, whether next door in Syria or in the larger regional conflicts. So there was a mismanagement of the public debt, of many of the economic crises that came in waves over the last decades, and the coronavirus impact. The street, the protest against the political elites, which also was a waking up call for everybody involved at home and abroad.
The International Crisis Group says Lebanon needs urgent international help and long demanded reforms to protect its people from their country's worst economic crisis. They said future governments will have to implement significant reforms, and such structural change will have to put an end to the current political model in Lebanon. What kind of change is needed to fix the political system in Lebanon?
Lebanon remains in the post-Taif Accord political system. Taif Accord, which has concluded the Lebanese civil war. So basically, you had before the Syrian regime basically managing this dysfunctional system. Now it has been on its own relatively in the last decade or so. It's been causing a lot of needs for concessional decision-making. There's a lot of sectarianism for political ends. So there's a lot of ideas to reform the system, but I'm not sure the political class is willing to lead this way, because reforming the system means ending the power of the feudal leaders and those who are basically now grabbing power. So the way to do that is very clear. It's a new electoral law. A new election basically changed the dynamics of not using public fund for political purposes and not using outside funding also to run elections and run campaigns. And also, of course, not using militarized political groups also to be involved in the electoral process. So the political process theoretically is clear the way to get there. But I think the protests in Lebanon failed to have a very strong platform that pushed for change. Now they're increasingly divided because of the power of the government and the ruling elite in general. So the path should be an electoral law, a set of reforms regarding the judicial, the media, decentralization of the system to have more voice for the Bekaa Valley or the north and the south, not only in Beirut. I mean, there's a lot of ideas, but you need political willingness. That's not present now.
Lebanon is seeking about $9 billion from the IMF on top of another $11 billion in grants and loans pledged by international donors in 2018, but never released because they relied on Beirut introducing reforms. Would Lebanon get such urgently needed funds, and under what circumstances?
The talks between Lebanon and the IMF started last month. I think it's going to be a slow process because of how the IMF function and how Lebanese also political system function. I think the $11 billion in grants will wait until Lebanon reach an agreement with the IMF. They put forward, as you said, an economic recovery plan. We have a problem of how to deal with the commercial banks. The government was not very forceful on this issue. We have the need for reform. How to break the cycle of the debt accumulation also is not clear. So they have a way to go, but obviously politics and economics gonna be entangled now. There will be some U.S. pressure that reforms or aid will not come unless the Lebanese government is neutral, is not too much close to Hezbollah. And the current government is trying to balance the two, appeasing the U.S. and also appeasing Iran. So there's no yet a clear roadmap. And because of the coronavirus, because of the political tensions at home and what's happening next door in Syria with the new sanctions on the regime there. So the road is not clear yet. And it's going to be messy, I think, down the road.
Joe Ma'akaran is a resident fellow at the Arab Center. He was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. A retired judge urged a federal court Wednesday not to allow the U.S. Department of Justice to dismiss its criminal case against U.S. President Donald Trump's former advisor Michael Flynn, citing evidence of a gross abuse of prosecutorial power. The U.S. district judge hearing the case tapped John Gleason last month to serve as a friend of the court after the Justice Department abruptly asked it to dismiss the criminal charge against Flynn, a retired Army lieutenant general. The Justice Department move followed a pressure campaign by Trump and his allies and came even though Flynn had pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about conversations with the former Russian ambassador to the United States. In South Korea, two North Korean defector-run groups targeted for legal action say they intend to continue sending propaganda leaflets and humanitarian aid into the North, despite criticism from the governments of both countries. South Korea, which is trying to improve ties with the North, accused the two groups on Wednesday of breaking the law by sending leaflets and aid such as rice and medicine. On Thursday, South Korea's Unification Ministry said it had asked Seoul police to investigate the groups. Britain said that any solution to the unrest in Hong Kong must come from within and not from China, adding there was still time for Beijing to reconsider a new security law that had sparked protests. In a new report, British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab said, quote, "The way through the current situation in Hong Kong is clear. All sides must invest in dialogue and reconciliation, underpinned by a robust, independent inquiry," end quote. The European Union's top Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, said on Wednesday that Britain is seeking a trading relationship that's too close to that of an EU member. It's a signal that there may be a long way to go before a finalized trade deal can be reached before the end of the year. Now, to learn more about the talks and where they may be headed, I contacted journalist Nicolas Pinault, who lives in Paris, France, via WhatsApp, to have that chat.
Well, you know, it's another round of talks, of negotiations, but it's not a disappointment. That's what the EU's person in charge of these talks, Michel Barnier, the French diplomat, mentioned yesterday.
The United Kingdom insists it is asking for nothing more than well-established precedents. But the truth is that in many areas, it is demanding a lot more than Canada, Japan, or any of our other FTA partners. In many areas, it is looking to maintain, in fact, the benefits of being a member state without the constraints. It is looking to pick and choose the most attractive element of the single market without the obligations.
So, Nico, so where do things go from here? Because it seems that there's been really no movement on Brexit negotiations.
Yeah, and negotiators, they're running out of time. So technically, you have this meeting was supposed to happen this Friday, the EU-UK Joint Committee. They're going to meet. You're going to have the European Commission Vice President Maros Vefcovic and Michael Gove, the UK Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. Basically, they're going to talk about the fact that they could not agree. And they have until the end of the month to set the tone. Are we going to be able to make a deal? Do we need an extension? And by the end of the June, you're supposed to have this high-level meeting between the UK Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and the EU Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen. And basically, they're going to tell the world, the European Union, and, people in Britain, that what's going on. Are we on a path to an agreement that, we can do the Brexit by the end of 2020, or do we need more time? Or let's just say, we cannot resolve our differences. So, let's just walk out without talking anymore. That's something very important. You have the trade issues. You have also something that the French government is very adamant about the fisheries. The idea is to be able for French fishermen to be able to fish in the waters around the UK. And of course, if there's no deal, that's something that's going to prevent fishermen. And that's something Emmanuel Macron doesn't want to happen.
You know, Nico, it sounds as if a no-deal Brexit is still legitimately on the table.
Each camp, they have their own leverages. I mean, let's be honest about that. The UK, they have something to gain. And the European Union have something to gain. So each of them, they want to really try to come up with the best deal. But let's say that you can feel more and more frustration on the European side, because basically what they're saying is that, UK asked to leave the EU. That's fine with us. They had a vote. And also right now we gave them more and more extensions to talk and to negotiate a better exit deal. But right now, it seems like we're never going to have this good deal according to the UK.
That was reporter Nicolas Pinault speaking to me from Paris, France. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.